The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Friday, the 14th of June, 2019. Excellent app for market notifications, latest company news, and access to current stock prices. Instant notifications of RNSs for companies you are watching is one of the best features and very reliable. Thank you, Eon One. That's a review for our app at the App Store. And do me a favor. If you do use the app, you get some value from it, and it's absolutely free to download. Please go to the App Store and give us a rating review. I'll read it out in the podcast, all right? If it's a decent one, of course. Okay, on today's podcast, Tony Menini, Chairman, and Peter Bird, CEO of Asia Met Resources, ARS, and they discuss the feasibility study, their maiden reserve, and update resource on their BKM copper project in Indonesia. Also on the podcast, David Siklatira, Chairman, and Brian Lowry, CFO of Live Company Group, and they talk about their operational and financial highlights as they release their final results for 2018 today. Plus, Russ Mould, investment director at stockbroker AJ Bell, talks about the semiconductor index and the following stocks: Truffin, Avesoro, and DS Smith. And as always, I have two lists for you: the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, you can see top 10 versions of both these lists at voxmarkets.co.uk, where you'll see a host of other content, from videos to articles to podcasts. Check it out right there, voxmarkets.co.uk.
To receive free company updates straight to the front screen of your smartphone whenever a company you follow releases significant news, download the free Vox Markets app from voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Tony Menini, Chairman, and Peter Bird, CEO of Asia Met Resources, ARS. Guys, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having us on, Justin.
Hi, Justin.
Now, you've had three big releases out today, and there's a lot of information there, and they are documents you have to, for compliance reasons, you have to put out in the same day. I understand that. There's a lot in there, so we'll try and simplify it and what you see is the most relevant points for investors. But as always, I like to do this, there's always new people listening. If someone's tuning in, then they've heard of you maybe, not quite familiar what you do. Can you just summarise quickly what AsiaMet's all about?
Yeah, thanks, Justin. Very quickly, AsiaMet is a copper-focused exploration and development company. We've got a terrific portfolio of copper and gold assets in Indonesia. The first of those that we will be talking about today is the BKM project, which is on the KSK property in Kalimantan. We've just completed a bankable feasibility study, and that project is moving into the development phase for a 25,000-ton capacity heap leach SXEW copper project, producing copper metal. And sitting behind that, on that broader portfolio in Kalimantan, there are a lot of targets to continue to build out mine life and the scale of the operation. We also have a second property in Indonesia, very large copper gold resource called Butong, which is at the resource phase and has had scoping level work complete. It's the next cab off the rank behind the Kalimantan properties. So, fantastic portfolio of copper gold assets in Indonesia. Team of people who have been doing this for a long time, have been behind the building of a number of copper and gold mines in Asia. That's really the AsiaMet story. Copper gold development, a heap of upside, and a team to deliver.
Yeah, okay. Well, so you've had the feasibility study out, you've had the BKM maiden ore reserve, and you've had updates on the resource. So let's dig in to the most, I suppose, what private investors were waiting for. Out of those three, what are we going for, Tony?
Yeah, so perhaps Peter here, Justin. Let okay, me pick Peter. That up. So the owners team and the consultants have sort of worked very diligently to deliver the BKM feasibility study today. So what investors have in front of them today, as you said, are three interrelated releases. The first one relates to the updated mineral resources, picking up recent drilling that we've done on the BKM property. The second one is the EKM Ore Reserves. This is a maiden reserve. Effectively, it's the commercialising of the resources for the listeners. And the third is the release of the results of the feasibility study incorporating a suite of inputs, including the above two releases. So if I could touch briefly on the highlights of the feasibility study, they're as follows. So as anticipated, a nine-year mine life copper project. It's an SXEW treatment or processing route, delivering copper cathode, which is pure copper metal, at a nameplate, peaking at a nameplate level of 25,000 tonnes per annum. Total cathode production for that period is about 173,000 tonnes at a cash cost, or what is termed a C1 cost of $1.65 per pound, with a project valuation of just under $134 million. The life of mine revenue on the project is around $1.27 billion, and the earnings before interest and tax, or the EBITDA, of $563 million. So not an insignificant project, and certainly a lot of upside from here. So just expanding upon that a little, as part of the study, we have identified, and it's in the announcement, a suite of value enhancement opportunities over and above that base case valuation. Each of these have been assessed, ranked, and risk value adjusted. What does that mean? It means that currently we feel that those opportunities have the potential to add another $35 million to the base value of project. If for listeners, what you'll be looking at going forward is that the feasibility is out and we have a suite of value opportunities in front of us. There are sort of four very specific steps we will follow in the next 4 to 6 months. So first of all, we'll investigate those value steps, that 35 of them, and I'm pretty optimistic that we'll have quite a deal of success there. We'll then fold the outcomes of that into the detailed engineering process, which is the next stage following a feasibility. In parallel with that, two things will occur. We will progress our mine permitting process systematically. Now, this is something listeners who have followed the story would be aware that we have systematically and efficiently retrieved our permits. So we'll keep working on that. And probably lastly and most importantly, we'll continue the discussions we have been having with third-party groups regarding partial or full financing of the ultimate project for development. So that's a summary of the outcome of that plethora of announcements today. That's really it in a nutshell.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, let me just, the share price at the moment, of course, while I'm talking, it could be up later today, but who knows? As I'm talking, the share price has gone down, and I've just had a friend tweet saying, what's not like here? I don't understand why the share price is going down. So, he's dug around and he said, in fact, people are questioning the IRR, which is 19.5%, and also they're questioning the price of copper you've based this on. So can you sort of address those two issues if people have concerns about that, please?
No worries. It's Tony here, Justin. These are common questions and always will be, particularly around the price. So, the thematic, okay, we're currently sitting somewhere around the $2.70 mark, and everybody can see the thematic in the public domain. The major companies, the mid-tiers and investors are really scrambling to find copper investment opportunities because in the near term, there's expected to be a significant deficit coming in the copper market. It hasn't hit yet. The market is fairly in balance or slightly in deficit, but the expectations are with the growth in copper usage with the urbanisation, industrialisation of the developing world, in particular Asia, coupled with the EV thematic sitting over the top of that the copper supply side will be very constrained, and as a consequence of that, we'll see the copper price rise. Now, when we do a study like this, we have to obviously select a price, and we don't just pluck that out of the air. There's actually some fundamental reasoning and defend, you know, we have to be able to defend that price. So what we've done here is typically what any serious group would do. We've done, we've taken the consensus prices of the major investment banks, the major global investment banks who forecast commodity price, and we've also used independent forecast prices from people like Wood Mackenzie, you know, one of the preeminent forecasters, independent forecasters, CRU, Brooke Hunt, to name a couple of others, and the consensus around those investment banks plus evidence when you look at the long-term forecast is $3.30, and hence that's the number we've used. So, you know, that's a very defendable, very real number based around expert opinion and analysis, not something that we've plucked out of the air overnight. Number one, so the copper price. You know, by the way, we expect copper price to go well beyond $3.30 in the outlook. But we've used $3.30 because we think that's a sensible number to use and a sensible number, as I said. So the second one being the IRR. Now, you know, I'm not sure what people's expectations are, but what I can tell you that if you dig around and have a look, you'll notice that the hurdle rates for projects for the major companies, whether it's BHP, Rio Tinto, Newcrest, or any others that you'd like to name, you'll see that their target rate for new project threshold is 20% IRR. And this project is a 20% IRR, sitting at 20% IRR now, or just under, and that's before the value enhancement opportunities that Peter has alluded to earlier on. The other thing I think that, you know, people perhaps maybe misreading is that it's difficult to compare copper projects with gold projects. Gold projects typically will have an higher IRR because they essentially have a shorter lead time to first gold being produced, given that they're relatively simple and easy projects to scale up. These are very robust, very good numbers for a copper project. As I said, you know, these are sort of threshold numbers for go ahead on new developments for any of the major companies. So, you know, we're very comfortable, very happy with you know, the IRR 20% because, you know, if, as Peter's alluded to, we'll continue to improve on that, and we'll have a project that's you know, I think is very investable and very bankable once with this additional piece of work.
Yeah, and so you say basically you have additional value enhancement opportunities identified with potential to improve valuation by a minimum of $35 million. So that's,
yes.
That sort of covers that. And just looking forward here, I mean, you know, all this work you put in, of course, there's loads of work you have to put in here, but what comes out of it from you? What are you excited about and what's next, guys?
Well, I think, as I said earlier, and as Tony alluded to, I think that the flight path and the actions for the next 6 months are pretty clear for us. With respect to BKM specifically, the value opportunities, you know, the first thing we'll address, and we'll do that immediately prior to the detailed engineering for this project, because they naturally fold into the detailed engineering. You don't want to do it afterwards and then change your detailed engineering. In parallel with that, what we hope we can achieve, and this is referenced in the announcement, is that immediately surrounding the BKM pit shell, which incorporates the resources and the reserves for this feasibility study, are some quite specific targets that we believe have potential to augment our current resource, which is over 400,000 tonnes of contained copper. But if we can identify within those targets leachable copper, clearly that has an immediate impact on two things. On our mine life is the first thing, and clearly the second thing is cash flow and the valuation. So it's in our interest to address those things immediately. And then post that effort, obviously, that engineering, you move into the development, sorry, funding development piece, which happened in parallel.
Yes, I'll just add there. So, I mean, Pete's alluded to the technical aspects. So, you know, the improvements at the look for improvements and value enhancements at the project level through a range of things. I guess simultaneously, you know, we have been progressing, as we've discussed previously, Justin. We had discussions with a number of parties. We've had a significant number of parties sign CAs. We've had a number of parties visit site and do due diligence. The delivery of this feasibility study today is sort of one of the key items that those various groups have been waiting to see. And, you know, we'll be on the phone, on the plane, in the meeting room with these groups next week and following up on any questions they've got with respect to, you know, what we've come out with today. Which I think fundamentally, you know, will support the diligence work that they've done, give them confidence, and we'd hope to progress those discussions to a conclusion with a third party, you know, fairly quickly. So that's the first part, and then that will enable us to have the capacity to do all the work that Pete's talking about at the project level, get the drawings turning again. And all of that, I think, equates to, you know, well, an exciting time for the business. This is a major milestone, Pete said. It's a major inflection point. I mean, if you think about it, the amount of work that's gone into this, the project is very much de-risked compared to where it was in the past. We see this as a sort of key inflection point for us. A real value catter event, if you like, and you know, we've got a lot of things in front of us to do, and that translates into, you know, strong news flow over the, you know, the course of this year, and obviously an exciting time as you put ahead into you know, construction, development, and operations. So, very exciting time, very, very, very significant milestone for us, really.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Okay, as always, if people's listening to this and they've seen the dip here, they see the opportunity in the dip, and they're not following the story as yet, give them those three quick reasons, Tony, at the end, why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets and add Asia Met Resources to their watch list, please.
Yeah, Justin, well, you know, there's three key reasons, and, you know, I think today there are even greater reasons to invest in the company. As I said, very major de-risking exercise. So you've got a company which got a development-ready project in copper space at a time when the copper markets are predicted to be taking off shortly. So, development-ready project, very, very large upside in terms of around that development and on other assets. So the assets are there to build a very significant scale business in the copper space at the right time. And you've got a team of people who've got, you know, the background experience, the drive, the passion and the skin in the game to deliver.
Marvellous stuff. Guys, it's good to chat to you as always. And hopefully we'll be catching up in the not too distant future. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is David Ciclatera, Chairman, and Brian Lawrie, CFO of Live Company Group, LVCG is the ticker. Guys, thanks for joining me.
Good morning, Chief.
Good morning.
Now, you've got your full year results out and already, pretty much. I mean, I always like to point out this is an historical document, and for a fast-growing company, it's out of date already, but it's always nice as a reference point to go back and see how you've done, and the growth is very good, and we'll go through the figures. But, David, before we get into that, there's always people who tune in. I know only pay attention to final results, which is not very appropriate for a fast-growing company, but if there are people tuning in to listen out, how would you describe Live Company Group?
Live Company owns the brand Brick Live. Brick Live is a brick building exhibition event company based on a global scale. We're in 50 different locations now. We have businesses that range from Japan to America. We own the brand. It's a AIM-listed company, obviously. I'm a significant shareholder, as are all the management. It is, as you quite rightly say, a new company. It had only traded for 5 days prior to the 2018 results you refer to. But that's what it is. It's a global educational kids brand running its own exhibitions around the world.
Yeah, and since these results, I mean, if you look at your timeline of news, there's been a lot. You've done a lot since. So, you know, these have to be sort of taken with a pinch of salt, I suppose. But nevertheless, let's go through what operationally, and we'll go into the figures with Brian in a bit, but let's go through operationally what you've achieved in 2018, if you could, David.
Well, if you think about where we started from, we at the end of 17, we'd just done a few shows. We had a very few assets. We had just begun to think about building a touring show. During the year, we obviously raised funds to build the company. We bought Bright Bricks for £8.5 million, which is the world's biggest Lego building company, employing 50 builders. From that, as Brian will explain, we have been, our assets have grown. It's all last year was a story of growth, really. The number of shows that we've gone to, the amount of bricks that we have under management, the number of assets that we've built, the touring shows that we've run. 18 was a sort of transformal year, really. If you look at where we've already achieved in 19, we've, you know, that growth has continued. And indeed, I'm sure Brian will refer to the fact that in our 2018 accounts, it actually refers to the amounts that we've already achieved this year. So, as I said, a very important year, showing growth and going from a company that was literally 5 days old when the year started.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, over to Brian. Take us through some of the figures, if you could there, Brian, for 2018, of course.
Sure. Yeah, I'd just like to expand, actually, on what Dave was saying. I mean, we were 1.9 million in 2017, 2018, and as you alluded to, a very, big increase in growth to 5.4 million. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's 178% increase in a 12-month period. It's astonishing. And then the net assets, the underlying assets of the business, we started the year at about 2.8 million. We're now up to 10.6. Predominantly as a result of the acquisition of Bright Bricks, which we've bought a lot of content, a lot of models, a lot of bricks. So it was a great year of investment to build a good platform for the coming year.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is worth pointing out. From 1.9 million, like I said, to 5.3 million, it's a big jump. And so I suppose the question is, going forward now, I mean, we had a loss for the year before tax of 2.1. But going forward, I mean, I've chatted to David a lot, and I know operationally, you know, its progress is going strong there. So going forward, what are we looking at? What are we hoping to achieve?
Absolutely. It is about looking forward. I mean, before we bought Bright Bricks, we just had one sort of touring show. We bought Bright Bricks, and that increased to having 9 touring shows. And even in the first quarter of this year, we are now up to 12 touring shows. So you can see the investment in these touring shows that we're making. And as a result of that, it's enabled us to take a lot of forward bookings and secure a lot of contracts. And even just in FY19 already, we're up to secured contracts of 4 million. And such is the demand that for FY20 and 21, we've also got some secured sales, 1.3 million in 2020 and 0.7 in 2021. So the pipeline is starting to get secured, and it's all built on this great base of all these touring shows that we now have.
I should add there that today, I think it was literally half an hour ago, our broker Shard has released an independent broker's note that can be found on the Shard website for your listeners. Obviously, it was originally produced for their own investors, but is there for any retail investor or anybody who wants to read it. It's quite a detailed note, as and basically sets out the analysts' views of our numbers for 19, 20 and 21, so a three-year growth pattern. So for the first time, we are now looking at a visible trajectory in terms of our results going forward.
Excellent stuff. And do you talk about, you know, heading towards profitability there?
Well, I should hope so. Yes. Absolutely. it's what it's about now. Yeah. It is about two things. I mean, I never want to cross over here with Brian because he's completely correct. It is about the company hitting the numbers that are in the marketplace, which are numbers that show profit. But it's also, as our last conversation a few days ago showed when we announced the partnership with Nickelodeon, that it's also about going to the next level. This company's always been about going upwards and growing to the next level. The advent of Paw Patrol, remember your kids' pajamas and stuff?
Yeah.
That is going to be a huge thing for this company. We've already had a huge interest from the outside, people trying to book this potential show. But, I mean, I personally believe that it will also mean that we will have lots of interest from around the world. And I believe that obviously where we started this year will show exponential growth beyond what we have now today.
Yeah, well, do you know what? It's a thing. It's you know, strong brands will only associate with strong brands, you know. And so, like I said, that Nickelodeon deal you did there was really validates, isn't it, what you're all about. And once you get one of those coming in like that big brand, then others will be, you'd be on the radar of other companies, I assume.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, we always talk about the fact that we are a company in line with our own shareholders, because the management of the company owns just under 50% of the company if you take options and all those sort of things. And we are really, really keen to see growth in shareholder value. And obviously, the value is not just seen in a P&L. It's seen in the brands that you own and the positions and contracts that you have going forward. So I think these accounts, you're right, actually, it seems a long time ago, January 18. It's taken Brian a huge amount of time to do this. It's quite difficult to sit with a group of auditors and look at 100 million bricks.
You weigh them, you count them, you do all sorts of things with them. But it was a great exercise. It took a while, but it just provides validity of what we actually own.
Yeah, well, do you know, when David said that originally, he sort of said it off the cuff, I think, about a couple of months back, and I didn't think about it, but I thought, no, actually, you do have to do that. There has to be a certain way you have to count all those bricks, and that's a near of an impossible job.
It's challenging. You weigh the bricks, you work out, you know, averages, you put in lots of detail on, you know, how weighted average for these bricks, and you get the number, and you know, there's been a lot of work going into that, because, you know, you don't necessarily always count every single brick you put in a model. There's good ways of making sure that you've got, you know, good accuracy on what you own.
Yeah. And so operationally, David, I mean, you've achieved so much this year already. Next sort of 6 months, we're nearly halfway through the year already. Next 6 months, what can people look out for?
Well, the first thing is that the company now is dedicated to ensuring that it is a profitable business for all of its investors. That's the first thing that we're driving as management looking forward. Obviously, we're also about growing the number of shows. We announced actually yesterday, we didn't have a chance to talk because I thought it would be a bit off doing it, talking to you every day, but we did announce that we were going to Tel Aviv yesterday.
Yeah.
There was an announcement going out there. So every day, every week, we're announcing something new. I think, as we both said, the relationships that we're growing are getting bigger and bigger. So, yes, it's all about the P&L target. As Brian said, our balance sheet has strengthened. It's all about growth. It's continuing the growth, continuing our position as a brand. And it's going to be a very, very exciting next 6 months. That's all I can tell you.
Marvellous stuff. And as always, David, let's get a call to action here. For people listening, liking the sound of this, who are not following the story, give them those three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets and add you to their watch list, please.
We own our own brand, which is kind of the key message. We are a global brand in many places. And the interests of all shareholders are aligned in that we basically are a, I wouldn't say owner-manager, it's the wrong word. I personally have 40% of the company. The management have pretty much just under another 10%. But we really, really want to work with our shareholders, and we welcome anybody who's new to join what is basically a group of like-minded individuals.
Yeah, absolutely. Marvellous stuff. David, Brian, thanks for chatting. Hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Russ Mould, Investment Director at Stockbroker AJ Bell. You all right, Russ?
Yeah, very well, Justin. How are you?
Yeah, I'm not too bad.
Good.
Not too bad.
Apart from the weather, obviously.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't, like I said, we just said it, nearly halfway through the year. It doesn't feel like a June, though, at all.
No, it's not
here?
Flaming June at the moment. No, I'm not a meteorologist, but it's not living up to its billing at the moment. So.
Yeah, it's about as damp as the Conservative Party race. I don't know why they're all still in it. Just leave the top three. Top three should be left in. Crack on. All these others just trying to get in there. Just drop out.
I suppose they're trying to have their say in who can be the next leader, I suppose, and suck up to the potential winner and salvage their careers or protect their careers, I suppose.
Yeah. So let's look at, globally. I know you look at the global sort of market a bit. Before we get into individual stocks, and we did mention there, you've done a thing on semiconductors. First of all, tell us why this is important, the semiconductors of index and all that stuff.
Two reasons. I mean, first of all, the semiconductor industry, silicon chips, it's a $400 billion plus global industry. And every year revenues, and you find silicon chips in everything from, your car to your smartphone to your desktop to wireless equipment, to your fridge to your smart meter. They're absolutely everywhere. So they're a pretty reasonable proxy for global economic growth.
Yeah.
And also, they're right at the heart of the China-America intellectual property row as well. So in that respect, they're a pretty good view into what's happening with trade and tariffs.
Yeah.
The second reason is the SOX index, the Philadelphia Semiconductor Index. You can track it for free on the internet. It's no problem at all. It's generally beloved by momentum junkies because these stocks trade off, they feed off earnings forecast upgrades, and they don't at all like earnings forecast downgrades in the manner of classic momentum stocks. And if you look at the SOX index, it's actually been a pretty good proxy for FTSE All World, S&P 500, again, because of its view into the economy. So if you look, the index peaked before everything else did in 2000 and 2007, and it bottomed before everything else did in 2003 and 2009. So with that in mind, it had an absolutely ripping 2019. The index is up about 20% from its lows. And one of the reasons for that is a lot of semiconductor companies have been saying, we know the first half's a bit sticky there, dear, don't worry. It's all going to be okay in the second half. And we're now getting, as you've said, to June. So you're starting to get outlooks for the second quarter, and then when they publish their second quarter numbers in July, you'll get the third quarter and fourth quarter earnings forecasts. And what's interesting is that last night, Broadcom, big member of the index, that blew the second half recovery story out of the water by basically saying it's not happening as we thought, and they've actually guided revenues down and profits down for the second half. Hock Tan, the chief executive, flagged a couple of things. He flagged slower wireless business. We know the global smartphone business is not full steam ahead at the moment because it's quite mature, as we've seen that in the Samsung and Apple numbers. He blamed, I think the very delicate phrase was, export and distribution issues for a major customer, which I would guess is Huawei under the circumstances. But he also said, I think most intriguingly, that customers are just a lot more nervous than they were. They're running inventory down and they're not ordering as far ahead as they would do normally. And I think that's the key read through, is that given the trade tariff economic situation, companies are just being a bit more careful. The stock got clocked. It was down about 8% after the close last night in the US. So we'll see. Now, if you look at the UK, IQE, CML Microsystems, Gooch & Housecoat, Spectris, Renishaw, XP Power, they're all involved in the semiconductor industry to some degree. I mean, IQE is a maker of very specialist chips for wireless. Spectris, Gooch, XPP, Renishaw are into semiconductor production equipment. they produce bits that are used in the manufacturing process. But let's face it, if the chip makers aren't happy, one of the first things they're going to do is cut their capex, right? So you might start to see that filter through. Now, Renishaw and Gooch have already put out some disappointing trading statements this year. Gooch had a profit warning just a couple of weeks ago, saying no second half recovery here, move along. And these stocks have actually done a lot worse than the Philadelphia Semiconductor Index. So maybe the British companies have just been a bit more upfront. Maybe investors are a bit more plugged in. So they've already done very badly. But it might be worth minding your eye on them when they publish their next reports, because they do feed into the same food chain.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's a bit worrying. I mean, and also this semiconductor index, it's only become going to become more relevant, isn't it? Because let's be honest, everything now pretty much, and it will going forward become more intelligent or internet connected. Yeah. So I think it's something we should watch it more closely. I think
it's a 30 stock index. I mean, ARM used to be in it. Yeah. You know, FTSE 100 until it was acquired by SoftBank in 2016. But it's mainly American companies. But there's a couple of Asian companies in there, like Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing. So, but it's a global industry, and the big leaders are all in America. Surprise, surprise, surprise.
And to be honest, I mean, we've seen the sell-off in sort of commodities, and I've seen juniors sort of explorers and all those companies tank recently because of the sentiment from China and all that stuff. Because you know, China highly leveraged, of course. I mean, they consume half the world's copper and all that stuff. So yeah, I mean, it's so it doesn't look very good for that kind of that sector.
It's making me a bit nervous. It would make me a bit nervous at the moment. Yes.
Do you know what? Luckily, I mean, I don't know if luckily, I was seeing bad news coming from China for a long time, but I decided to just exit all, if I had any positions in resource or oil and gas companies, smaller, you know, explorers, I did exit last September, and I thought I was going over the top, but now I'm sort of glad I did.
There's a quote, for the great players, even luck is a matter of skill.
I think it's great luck. Do you know what it is? It's just reading and understanding. Hang on, understanding where the leverage comes from. You know, China pretty much is the biggest consumer. Yeah. They're having problems. They're slowing down. This trade war went on longer than we thought, and always those are the kind of things. So there I just thought it's
an avoidable
risk. I thought, you know,
there you are.
I know
you've
about
done
it.
Your research.
Yeah. So let's go on to individual stocks. What are we looking at?
Yes, so a couple of small caps that we've looked at before with varying degrees of success, and then an income stock that we've looked at before. So the small cap is Trufin. Now you'll remember we first looked at it about a year ago, and the shares largely paddled sideways. They actually didn't do very much at all.
What did they do
remember
there?
It's a very complex company, and the real key to it was, in some ways, they were applying for a banking license to the Prudential Regulatory Authority for their supply chain finance business DFCH, and they didn't get it. So the share price was just going. And then, so what they decided was they were going to demerge DFCH. So they've actually, if you were own Trufin shares from, say, a year ago, you've now got one share in Trufin and one share in Distribution Finance Capital. So you've actually, you know, so I know that share price plunge looks precipitate, but you've actually been given a spin-off in return. So DFCH came out at 90p. It's actually gone to £1.25 since, and Trufin's still paddling around at about the sort of 78-80p level. So you've now got a share in two businesses. You've got a share in DFCH, which is the supply chain finance business. It provides finance to manufacturers and dealer networks for things like motorbikes, caravans, yachts, and industrial kit. It's a niche where banks just do not want to play. They have no exposure to automobiles, which some people might view as a good thing. And we've got some auto exposure through SNU anyway. Mm-hmm. The PRA licensing has been delayed again. It's now likely to be the autumn. If it happens, it should be good for funding, because it means they're not having to borrow in the wholesale markets. They'll be using deposits, which is just going to be miles cheaper. Trufin, it's now spun off DFCH. It sold its 12% stake in peer-to-peer lender Zopa for 45 million quid. So it's cashed up. It's got two businesses now, Oxygen and Satago. Again, provider of financial services, Oxygen, early payment invoicing systems for councils, Satago, networking capital, cash flow management, factoring for small and medium enterprises. Both businesses are loss-making. Both have got niches. Both have got great potential. It's high risk, potentially high return. It's certainly not widows and orphans stuff, but one thing that you should note is that Trufin has just done a £5 million tender offer, and it's going to return another £5 million to shareholders, all goes according to plan, in December. So that does it. I thought I'd better explain, looking at the Trufin share price chart, why there was that vertiginous drop down. It's because you actually now own a share in DFCH.
Yeah. One of the reasons why I sell a stock is if the story has changed, you know, significantly.
This one has changed.
Yeah,
so.
And especially if it's changed significantly to the worst. So in my mind, to me, if it got a bit complex now, you understand it, what's going on, I would be just I just dump and get out, you know, because there's always time to reflect, I think, and move on, you know. But it's changed, isn't it? You know, the story's changed a bit, you know.
Yeah, and you need the PRA license to come through for the DFCH business, or you know, the shares aren't likely to go anywhere. So that's the next big catalyst. So you can sit and wait, I think, probably.
Yeah. Cool. Okay. What's the next one, Russ?
Deep sigh. Avasoro Resources, ASO, AIM. It's really one of those things that just makes you realise why gold mining investing is such a challenge. Because the theory that we outlined a year ago was, look, the economy is at risk here. Central banks could easily backpedal and unorthodox policies become orthodox ones. We've already got people talking about Fed rate cuts, the ECB talking about more credit for banks. And gold is starting to respond. It's back up the $1,350 an ounce level for the fifth or sixth time in the last two or three years. I'd be intrigued for your view on the gold price chart in a minute, but you think, okay, well, gold's starting to move. Gold miners particularly will be leveraged into that, and especially junior ones. So blow me down. We've just toughed out a couple of production disappointments from Avasoro, and now it's come out with an absolute howler. Another cut in production guidance. It's decided to subcontract out production at its mines in West Africa. And as a result, the miners at the Younger mine have gone on strike.
Oh, nice. Yeah, yeah.
So there's nothing coming out of there at all now. And that's leaving the company brushing up against some of its financial requirements. So the share price has just gone absolutely through the floor. So you've had a catalogue of production misses, variable production, and now you've got a strike. Yeah. All you can say in its defence is it's trading below book value. You'd assume the strike's going to get resolved at some stage and the gold price is going in the right direction. But if ever there was an advert for buying an ETF for junior gold miners...
I'm just going to say the same. I was just going to say, do you know what? Many people say you should always have exposure to gold, but how you get that exposure is the question, isn't it? You're better off going for an ETF, a basket of gold companies, rather than going to one because you have specific issues. You know, like I said, and a lot of these gold miners are, you know, located in dodgy jurisdictions or jurisdictions where you've never been to in your life, never even seen. There's a higher risk there. So I think if you get an ETF, you spread that risk across 50 companies or whatever, it's a lot. Like I said, gold now is hitting 1357.
Yeah, so talk me through that chart, because seems to be right on a massive resistance. Exactly. I'm no chartist, but it seems to be right on a massive resistance point, yeah?
It's hit this point in July 2016 and August 2016, back to August 2017.
Four or five times.
But that means sooner or later, if it breaks... it'll be a strong move north.
You'd think you'd go to 16, 17 straight away. Yeah.
It's a big run here. So, do you know what? This is quite interesting because you're thinking, what's going to push this higher? And it is the worry about currencies, obviously.
It'll be central banks saying, you know what, this QE thing, let's have a little bit more. And I think that will be, if it happens, a big trigger for gold, potentially.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I hadn't looked at the gold price for a while, but that is very interesting. Mm-hmm. We are interesting levels here. We're at the top of that. It's almost like since 2015, that top range, right nudging that, and if it breaks through this time, that's a powerful break of a powerful bit of resistance there. It'll break through that. That's going to be a big strong move, you know. Anything else, Russ? Stop.
So just on income, just to close out, slightly more prosaic topic from gold and cock-ups in West African mines. DS Smith, we've looked at it before at about 340, 345p in March, just saying it's potentially a reliable income stock here. We've just had full year results. And the stock had actually done really badly, going from £5 to that £3.50 when we looked at it, because it made a big acquisition in Spain that people were frightened it overpaid for, that was worried over Chinese production, worries over retail, worries over container board prices coming down. But the full year results look relatively reassuring. Sales were nicely up, operating margin, no sign of margin pressure, hurrah. Earnings per share up, and the dividend up 13%. Twice covered by earnings with some good free cash flow. Management, I know talk is cheap, but they've actually just upgraded their medium-term margin targets, which is encouraging. And so you've got a stock on about 9x forward earnings with a 5% dividend yield twice covered that's got a strong position in its field. And if there is a massive retail meltdown, it will struggle a little bit, but a lot of it is businesses for consumer staples, so it's not the end of the world. There'll be a lot of other stocks suffer a heck of a lot more than this one. So again, I just think it's a good bullet hole, and if you're an income hunter, you're getting what looks a reasonable, a 5% yield at the moment, which you would like to think looks pretty safe, all things being equal. So we'll income hunters, I know we've had Vodafone cut its dividend, and Marks and Spencer's cut its dividend. So you've always got to be careful and keep your eye on the cash flow. But for the moment, at least this one is one that looks being what it's supposed to be doing.
Yeah, and let's be honest, the risk.
SMBS.
It was famous last words, but the risk to the downside seems limited because they've hit £3 and they've bounced off that nicely, and they've done a higher low at 3, sort of 20 odd, and they're at 3.56. So I'll be surprised if they go below £3 again.
I'd like to think the valuation will give you a bit of downside protection if anything goes wrong, and some upside potential if they continue to execute.
Yeah, SMDS is a ticker there.
That's the one.
Marvellous. Any plans for the weekend, Russ?
Absolutely bonkers. Daughter's got a hockey practice tonight while my lovely lady wife's out on the source, so I'm doing the chauffeuring business. And then lad's got a junior, got a cricket match tomorrow under 10s, and then we've got a summer fete in the afternoon.
Yeah.
So it's one of them weekends, same as you probably.
We got a summer fete and all that stuff, but we should be putting out, it's Father's Day, Russ, we should put our feet up, I think.
I gather something is planned, but I've not been told what, so I'm looking forward to finding out. Hopefully a slap-up lunch somewhere will do the trick quite nicely.
Exactly. Marvellous stuff. Let's catch up next week, Russ. Cheers, fella.
Have a great one.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five, Way Education, W-E-Y. Coming into the buy zone, I think, of course, if you've done your own research and you're happy with your research, then you're confident in the company, check it out. At four, SafeStay, had them on the podcast yesterday, up 15% today, SSTY. And very interesting what they're doing, the hostels, but they're premier sort of, you know, if you look at the, go to the website and you'll be surprised. I stayed in hostels as a kid, and they're nothing like these guys have got, their luxury premier sort of offering. But still very cheap, and they're building a sort of mini empire at the moment. 14 they have so far in Europe. They're going for 40. So check them out, SSTY. At three, Bidstack Group. Everyone's keen to get James from E3. Listen, James, he has contacted me on LinkedIn, and he did say he was going to do a podcast, but he is so busy, and he said we're doing loads of meetings back-to-back. It's really exceeding. You know, what they thought was happening. So hopefully we'll get some news, but listen, you know, they're in a very exciting space. Add to Emotion Group. Good news out today on those. Nice little deal with, you know, big company, Servio, I think it was, an MGM-backed company for a VR deal. But that's very interesting. Hopefully we'll get Martin on the podcast very soon from that company. And I cover them on the weekend as well in my video. And number one, most followed company is Agronomics. It's A-N-I-C, of course, Clean Meat Investor. I think it's going to be, I've covered that in the video, I think it's going to be a mega trend, a meta theme, as they call it, over the next 5-10 years. In fact, I just retweeted, Vietnam have a problem with pigs. And it's an emergency with pig disease and all that stuff. And Clean Meat does, you know, don't have that problem with Clean Meat. So it sounds odd at the moment, but check out my video. Just do a search on YouTube for Justin Waite, videos, investment, whatever, and it'll come up. Agronomics is that company. Or just do Justin Waite, A-N-I-C, YouTube. You'll probably get it coming up. Okay, top five most followed companies. So most liked RNSs in the last 24 hours. At five, Anglo-African Oil and Gas, publication of independent report for Tilapia. At three, Asian Met Resources, BKM Maiden Ore Reserve. At three, so that was four, that was at three, Asian Met Resources. I was confused because Asian Met again. Updates, BKM Copper Resource. At two, Infrastrata, SNIP or SNIP Reverse Flow, EU Feed Study, Grant Application. That's Infra. And number one is from Asian Met again. They've got three out of the top five here. Feasibility Study confirms robust copper project. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.